And welcome to the next session. The panel is going to be looking at the question of continuing the discussion of earlier this morning. Is there such a thing as public media 2.0? What's going on? I've been asked to have a first look around the horizon, tell you some things which you probably already know, but maybe a slightly different take on it. Okay, I suspect that many of us actually are naturally beguiled by the idea of participative media, because coming out of maybe a public services, we would say in Britain, ethos, it fits the religion. And particularly at a time when mainstream, top-down, big media are clearly, I don't think there's any argument about it, failing the democracy in many countries, it's a beguiling thought that this could be an alternative. It could be an alternative because it's an empowerment of the audience. Therefore, it's a chance for the audience to take up the means of production and to flex their democratic muscles. You can see why we're beguiled. So I just want to do a little reality check. And I want to look at that word, power. Just see where the power actually is in some of the new things that are going on. Follow the power in this emerging landscape. Who has it? Who has the control? My favorite program is Democracy Now! And I can only get it in the UK thanks to podcasting. I can watch it anytime, any place, while doing anything else. And I actually give up quite a good deal of my time each day to watching it as a result of that. So that's more power to me, because it's a great show, I think, and it's more power to the show because it's one more audience member and I guess many thousands more around the world. But actually, so from that point of view, it's a no-brainer for public media to say, let's use every new means of distribution that's coming. You invent a new one, we'll go on it. They've done that, and I think it's, as I say, a no-brainer. But of course, when you look at the show, it's an absolutely traditional 60-minute news show with very, very little different about it. And in fact, if I'm watching it in the podcast mode, I've got no chance to interact with it at all. I've actually been slightly disempowered compared with a traditional live audience where I've got a chance to phone in, to email in, or whatever it is. So contrast that with the device that many people are saying is going to be the end game for the coming decade, which is the multimedia phone. Because here you have got live stream. You've got your full digital 300 channels or whatever being broadcast, but you've also got the back channel. You can use 3G, either you can use it to download video in the same way, or you can use it to interact. So the power in this sense would seem to be more with the user again. I can really interact. And I think it's important in looking at the public media to realize the importance of this aspect of liveness. I think people in the media often think that live is important as opposed to downloaded because of some news event or something. It's also crucially important if you're talking about interactivity and you want the audience to be actively involved. So I've got more power as a user, but maybe I've got less power because I may have to pay an awful lot for this. I mean, the actual financial models that I know of, certainly, for a data transfer are hugely disadvantageous to the user, very, very expensive to download video clips. You may say, well, that's a sustainability model, and it is in a way. Once the price comes to a reasonable level, you may equally say, well, I can't wait for WiMAX to actually wipe out that whole financial model anyway. Now, the BBC is an interesting case. It's been mentioned earlier. 2 weeks ago, they released a major study called Creative Futures and unleashed what they call the second digital wave for the BBC. This is the new BBC IP-based player. It uses a form of BitTorrent, which is going to be very interesting in terms of the impact for audience and others. It's very interestingly distinguishes between viewers in the UK and viewers outside the UK. It uses DRM, and you have a 7-day window on the programs of the last week. It mixes radio and television completely equally with that 7-day archive. So you might say that's pretty good. That's a lot of more power to the user, and on-demand certainly takes away the power of the scheduler, as is obvious, and gives it to the user to choose when and where he or she will watch the programming. And he can mix radio and television in an equal way. He can move, look at the archive, look at the current stuff. He can look at live stuff, can look at downloaded stuff. But then when you think about it and you look at this screen, you begin to realize this is a walled garden. Actually, this is rather less powerful for the user. It's fine if you're happy to stay inside the BBC, but it's a very, very major pressure to keep you inside there. And so Mark Thompson then talked about a second major change coming, which is, he said, we need a new relationship with the audience. They need to be not just audiences anymore, but participants. Same thing we've been hearing about this morning. But how does that actually play out in the thinking of the BBC? There was a big conference last week, some of us were at, called We Media, and they were talking about precisely this. What is this relationship? Is it, for a start, such a new relationship? After all, we remember Mr. Zapruder's 8mm film making it into the media. We remember the phone-ins coming in from the 60s for audience participation. We even remember the letters that have been sent from time immemorial to radio and television. Today, that, of course, is replaced by the camera phone, by the podcasts, and by the bloggers. But is it essentially any different when seen from the point of view of the broadcaster, seen from the point of view of the BBC in this case? Where is the power? And the BBC was very clear, I have to say, others who were at the conference may disagree with this, but I thought they were very clear that they were going to keep the power because of the importance of their brand. The BBC, like many other public broadcasters, sees itself as a trusted brand. And if they let in, past that gate, material, whether it's from blogs or from video phones or podcasts or anything else, that turns out to be not accurate or libelous or breaching copyright or whatever it might be, essentially diluting their brand, their identity, which is based on accuracy, impartiality, balance, and the rest of it, then they are in serious trouble. So I think, as was said earlier this morning, this is an important balance. We're clearly not talking about no gatekeeping, but equally a very tight gatekeeping actually isn't going to be a dialogue with the audience, as the Director General was saying. It's just going to be an invitation to participate that's always been there anyway, with actually rather richer material coming in, and incidentally no suggestion yet that they would be paid for it. A better model for participation, at least seen from the outside, is Current TV, which I followed since it was launched with a lot of interest to see how well it would work. And I'd be very interested in people's reactions. I don't know how well it's working. They say 30% of the material is now, as broadcast, coming from not only stuff that's been submitted, that's not the half of it. The real point is that the audience is also voting for what is green-lighted and thus shown and what is not. So that is definitely more power to the audience for at least 30%. But what about the viewing audience? What kind of experience is it for them? I don't know. Is it a coherent experience to watch this segmented output? I don't know. I suspect the jury is still out on that. Much more striking, I think, is the kind of radio work that was described this morning. And again, I enjoy listening to the podcasts from Open Source. And there, it's a much deeper dialogue because it goes right through the process of making the programs, as we heard this morning. So it's a genuine participation. Of course, again, it's not open to everything that we heard. There are analysts who at a certain point will make decisions. There are professionals who decide what will, and no doubt there are lawyers who will decide what can be and what can't be in the program. But to some extent, this is the most open model that I at least have seen around the place. If you compare it with YouTube, which I suppose is the phenomenon at the moment, this gives huge power to the filmmaker. If you like, no gatekeeping as far as one can see at all, copyright, anything more or less goes, there's some changes happening to that. But as a viewing experience, of course, it's massively incoherent. Or is it? Is it incoherent as it stands, or is it actually raw material that others will use as a basis for programming? And this, I think, goes to the question of whether public media can use these new common spaces rather than creating spaces of their own. And One World, that's the thing we're really looking at, whether we actually need to host video anymore ourselves, or whether actually we don't do better to tag material that's hosted elsewhere. Because as a filmmaker now, you're faced with quite a tricky problem as an independent. Which of 10, soon to be 20, soon to be 100 sites do I upload this thing to? Each one takes a few minutes and all the rest of it. Is it actually worth it? Wouldn't it make more sense actually to from an aggregation point of view, to be going to certain sites. But then, of course, you have to believe they're still going to be there in a year's time, et cetera, lots of issues like that. At One World, we tried to address the incoherent problem of short form, very short form submitted clips by what One World TV did to try and make a connected narrative, a shared narrative between the users. So as you were looking, for example, at this piece here, it comes to an end after a couple of minutes, and then you've got a choice of three follow-on pieces. May have been made by the same filmmaker, may have been submitted by another filmmaker, and indeed you have the opportunity then to submit within that same narrative stream and say, well, I've got something which responds to that, or complements it, or contradicts it, or whatever. And we hope, therefore, the idea of a shared, coherent narrative would actually be an intriguing way to open up the documentary into this shared space. I have to say it's been a failure. People haven't so far wanted to do it. Whether it was too early, whether the subject matter was too rarefied, I don't know, but I still believe in it. If we look at what Yahoo is doing with video, we've got another interesting model again, because unlike Google, as I understand it, they're hosting very, very little themselves. Basically, they are, of course, providing a massive search and a certain amount of recommendation under certain subject headings. So from a user's point of view, there's a lot of power here in the user's hands. There's no walled garden at all, though I notice there are not many Google-hosted films there, but that may be a coincidence. From the point of view of the power of the Yahoo editors, it's not particularly great because they're doing some recommending in a fairly light way, and they can it keeps changing. And in time, obviously, that recommendation system could be built on users more. But it raises the question, I think, for public media, and it raises it in my mind, as to how far along a spectrum you want to go. Because that spectrum starts with making programs. That's what broadcasters used to do. They were the only ones who had the equipment and the union agreements to do it. Then at a certain point you say, well, we don't actually have to make them. We can commission them. So you then commission the independents and you run a channel based on a mixture of your own programs and commission, like Channel 4 in the UK. Then you could take a step further and say, well, actually, we don't need to commission them at all. We could just aggregate them. A lot of other people are making films already. They're on various sites. We could just aggregate that and do a kind of Google Video is doing in a way. Or you could go all the way and say, no, we don't even need to do that, aggregate them in our space. We can just recommend them. So we just work at a meta level with links, tags, and all the rest of it, and we create a media experience, nothing we've made, nothing we've commissioned, nothing we've aggregated and put on our site. And at One World, we're just wondering now whether that isn't a more elegant way to go into the future. In other words, you just tag things One World, just as people here are tagging things beyond broadcast. You don't actually have to upload it to a different site. So interesting levels of power there and decisions for public media bodies. Meanwhile, of course, the video bloggers are saying, to hell with all your things. We're just going to get on. We're going to keep the power. Why should we come up to your gate at all? Why should we be subject to your controls? And this is what Raymond Christensen, an early blogger from Scandinavia, says. We don't need the mainstream media to tell us what's interesting anymore. Millions of people want to tell their stories. With video blogging, they can tell their stories. So complete independence. But then, of course, people say the problem with that is, okay, you can tell your story, but if I remember from the 60s, you've got this problem that, who's actually going to be listening? To which I think we have to say a surprising number of people. The idea that a mass audience is the only audience, as we know, is no longer a fashionable thought. Instead, the long tail is the fashionable thought. And at One World, we tried a thing in which people had a direct audience to address their pieces to. It was the time of the G8 leaders meeting in Edinburgh. And we said, well, if you've got a video phone and you want to say your piece to the G8 leaders, then say it to the camera phone, mail it to this. The software will put it automatically on the site. Everyone will see it. And indeed, we will choose the best ones, and by prior arrangement, we sent them to the delegations of the G8 leaders. Whether or not any of them watched them is another thing, but I won't take time to play them now, but you can play them right off the screen. In terms of the long tail, I tried a little experiment, which is just to see, and many of you, I'm sure, have done the same thing, to see what kind of traffic one actually gets on YouTube with a, quote, serious subject. I mean, not being able to do karaoke in a dorm any longer. I had to do that. So this was a coverage on my mobile phone of a climate change demo last year. A number of clips put up, and 5,000 viewers. I thought that was well worth it. It took me about 15 minutes. It cost almost nothing. And 5,000, I think, is a really good return. So I think in terms of scale, one certainly can believe that the long tail has got some interest. Just since other people have been talking about their family, I will just mention that my daughter's gone the opposite route and took 10 years to make her film McLibel about the McDonald's libel film, which by contrast has been seen by 34 million people, primarily because it's gone through a very wonderfully old-fashioned thing called cinema feature release for documentary. She's planning to do another film, to take another, probably another decade on Big Oil, which she's making at the moment, and then she's going to stop. So her career will be three films. Huge audiences, huge impact, hopefully, hugely important. There are still people who think that's the way to go, equally as the short form, short attention span. People have talked about digital divide, and this is a great concern for One World. In Africa, the ICT delivery channel of choice is undoubtedly the mobile phone. And there, we're working with exactly the same principle, that people want information, they want to share information. In this case, it's about job opportunities being posted by one person going to other people. 300,000 SMSs a month now going out in Kenya. And a model which is sustainable, since people pay a small amount for the messages. In Africa, it's more, in South Asia, it's more like the telecenter movement, which many of you have been involved in. And this directly addresses the language issue, a project that we started many years ago with the Bergman Center as one of the partners, called the Open Knowledge Network. It's about empowering people at the village level who can't afford continuous access to the internet, who only speak a local language and are only concerned with local issues, to have software which enables them to work offline and yet to share and to be part of a conversation which can spread around local villages, to towns and beyond. So finally, I just want to say that the blogger in a way symbolizes for me, and this is a famous blogger from Iraq, the real value of the change. And the real value is not, in my view, and I'm picking up this idea from Lawrence Lessig and other people, not that they're better journalists. I mean, sometimes they're lucky because of where they are, sometimes they're very expert, and that's of value. But their real contribution is their freedom. The fact that they are not tied to a career path as journalists, to an organization that is going to actually gatekeep what they say. They're not tied to advertising, which is going to affect the broadcasting, doesn't apply, of course, to many of your stations so much. And they're not pinned down by the fact that they won't get access to the White House if they say the wrong thing. So I think there is a real hope, in my view, and I throw it open to the others, for Public Media 2.0 to find in these new tools a way of accomplishing its historic mission. And to just use a phrase for that mission, which the co-founder of One World very much likes to apply to One World, to be the open edge of the spirit of the people. It's perhaps a phrase that could serve for Public Media 2.0 as well, if you don't mind too much who said it. Because it was written in 1849 by the editor of the Neue Rheinische Zeitung, one Karl Marx. And what he wrote was, "The free press is the open edge of the spirit of the people, the articulate bond that ties the individual with the state and the world. The free press is the intellectual mirror in which a people sees itself. A self-viewing, and self-viewing is the first condition of wisdom." Thank you very much. So now I'm delighted to introduce a different panel than in your hymn sheets. It would have been particularly nice if Lynn Johnson could have been the first non-white male. And I'd love to have heard what she had to say about blogging and working with disadvantaged minorities in Vibe.com in New York. Sadly, she's not here. And sadly, too, Bill Gannon can't be here from Yahoo for family reasons. He was very much looking forward to coming, I know. So I pass to Paul Jones and to Skip from Microsoft, who's kindly sat in at short notice. Paul Jones first is the distinguished director of eBiblio.org, which is a contributor-run digital library. Paul.
Thank you. I thought I'd talk a little bit about what iBiblio is, in case you don't know. Some people who've been in open-source software know us from the late 1980s and early 1990s as SunSite, UNC-EDU. We pioneered SunSite, so many people here may have downloaded their software, their first Linux from us, some of their first GNU software, although you could probably get it a little quicker here from MIT. iBiblio is a collection of collections. We collect people and groups with interesting information that they want to share freely with others. And we facilitate that by software development and by using new technologies. So you have a little idea over here that we have a tremendous amount of Linux software. Some of it is completely written by people out in the world. They have, for the past 15 years, contributed their own metadata, filled it out. We don't even check the metadata. We have a software that does that. They go back and verify it, and we have a rich metadata-based search engine that takes care of free software online. Then we did another little trick about 12 years ago. We put the first radio station on the air. And this is the Jeopardy question that our local station wanted. We had a choice between the local NPR station, WNC, and WXYC. And we worked with WXYC because no one could tell the difference if the signal broke up. And XYC celebrated this by doing a completely open CD of contributed music that was available by BitTorrent over 2 years ago. So, and we also simulcast, of course, all the events that happen with that and so forth. And you can still get the free music if you want it. It's still available, and it's still available by BitTorrent. We've also been involved with video blogging. So this is videobloggers.org, one of the over 2,000 sites that are not software-related that we host. We also host a research project called the Open Video Project, which has to do with marking up video, making surrogates, determining when surrogates are needed. We do a lot of this in cooperation with archive.org and the Prillinger Archives. It's an NSF-funded project also. We have a research side, we have a contributory side, we have an education side there. This is just to give you things. We don't just do things that are in America. This is a site put together by people in the Tibetan community in exile at Dharamshala, India. They had a lot of people that wanted to learn HTML, take care, get their story out, get information out to different people in internet cafes, and they deputized a bunch of monks over time to do a variety of different sites. The exile communities are very high problems of AIDS and HIV, so anywhere in the world, and these guys have tried to attack some of that. They also have a journalism association, and these guys wanted to be in communication with other journalists. Some of the sites, we had about 30-some sites grow out of one Tibetan site that we picked up 12 years ago. Part of that happened because the Dalai Lama decided that all monks needed to learn science and that information science counted. So all these guys got busy. Now we're migrating some of those off to servers in Dharamshala, or they're marrying it within India. And there are various, of course, censorship issues with that, but that's all right. Speaking of censorship, we also have one of the largest archives that deals with Burma going back to before the takeover there. This is managed out of Switzerland because you can't manage out of Burma. So that pretty much touches on that. This past January, we did a complete unconference, unless you ask Dave Weiner, who says it's not a complete unconference because we gave away an O'Reilly book as a door prize. But we did this, much like this, it was a surprise conference. We thought we would draw maybe 100-some people from around North Carolina. We drew 350 people from all over the U.S., and we had no advertising budget. We did it all by blogs, listservs, and basically viral. And we also did it at a time when the university was not in session because we could get the buildings then, so we actually lost student attendance on that, and we're re-looking at that for our next one out for PodcasterCon. I think our total cost was under $2,000, and we fed everybody. As long as they wanted to be vegetarian, it was fine. And I wanted to say a little bit about software development because people have mentioned BitTorrent here is an issue. We've done some add-ons to the BitTorrent server. This isn't just an iBiblio pitch, but we're going to get somewhere with this. Basically, for us, BitTorrent has two places that it breaks if you're an information provider. One is there's not a permanent seed. That means you can't find the seed all the time. They kind of age out and go away. And I mean, because it's meant to be semi-anonymous, right? But if you don't mind being reliable and authoritative, you want that seed to turn around. The other thing that we've added is collectible and distributable structured metadata for the items that are in BitTorrent. So what that means is using something like the Open Archive Initiative or any other harvesting, you can harvest, I'll geek out just 1 minute more, Dublin Core structured metadata. So it's well understood, and there's a lot of free software out there that can parse it, and you can present it however you want it, and you can collect based on title and all that kind of good thing. Other project that I thought I'd talk about, because it has international and multi-language use, is we developed a multi-version, multi-user version of WordPress, and this is kind of in the face of the guy who's doing the multi-user version, because we couldn't get his to scale in our lab, and so we created a scalable one. Basically, what this is you can run your own blogspot.com wherever you are. So one installation up to 20,000 bloggers that can be related to each other. This is already installed in Lithuania, France, and South Africa, and it's only at 0.31. So it's getting there in part quickly because, you know, we use WordPress as the backbone, and those guys do a really great job on single install blogs. Not so good on, we think, in multi-purpose blogs. So I wanted to touch on some of those to show you some of what we're up to. There are other things we do that you might recognize but haven't seen. We're the home to eTree.org, which is one of the largest free music distributors. This is legal free music by bands that want their music traded that's recorded live off the boards. What I like about this, and we're talking about since we're talking about the futures, these guys created their own database. They police their own metadata. They're completely anal about the quality. They will kick stuff off. They will diss it. They will demand, if you don't have the right cord, the right connector, and the right microphone documented, they will rewrite your metadata, or they will kick you off, and they will not accept stuff from you. That said, they have thousands of concerts right now. And we're also the home to Project Gutenberg, which you probably, many of you are familiar with. We've been the home to those guys for a while. We have some additional video projects that have to do with retrieving and preserving films shot in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s of American folklore practices. And that's in part funded by the Institute of Museum and Library Services. All of these wonderful documentary filmmakers that were funded by NEH, their films are in their barns because they're going to be really valuable one day. And some of them who are world famous, whose names I won't mention, are running their films because he's going, oh, this one looked really good, but a rat got into it. However, it's going to be really valuable one day. And our deal is to get, so far we've got up to 60, but we own 120 of these out there that cover all parts of the American experience. So this is from families of gospel singers, visionary artists, boat builders, potters, people who are living an alternative but completely folksy lifestyle, whether they be the runaways in San Francisco creating dolls, which they call Sado babies, to people practicing the rural Mardi Gras, the Cajun Mardi Gras. So, and filmmakers vary from people like John Cohen and Les Blank and Tom Davenport to others. So I just wanted to give you a brief overview of the kind of thing that we're supporting because, and also I should say that we stream 8 radio stations right now. So, and we're collaborating with an entire collection of those. They're all within North Carolina, however, so because we have to get their signal. So, what's going to happen next with this? Well, the way that we get at what happens next is to open ourselves to the experience of the contributors and to put them in touch with each other. So you may have noticed that, for example, we have a few RSS feeds here from a few people, and they're highly varied. Some of these people keep their stuff up to date. Some of them don't. Some of them don't care. We also tried cataloging the things in a sort of universal decimal system organization. We don't do it by Dewey because that's owned and trademarked. So I can't say it's Dewey, but if you look at universal, it looks like what Dewey created in the 1800s. So, yeah. But we won't tell anybody who owns it that. So there's just a bit of what we're up to. We do contributors that do music. Some people make projects out of this. One guy who's been with us for over 10 years is a musician named Roger McGuinn. And he's every month for the past 10, over the past 10 years, he's recorded a different American folk song and given it away on the internet. And they're still all available. You can subscribe. And he also sells them at his concerts. So he feels like he sort of owes a debt to folk music because a lot of people think he ruined it when he recorded Mr. Tambourine Man and took it all electric. So he's now, I'll have to say, that doesn't keep him from using a 12-string Rickenbacker on a lot of the cuts he does.
Okay.
Am I done, Tom?
Thank you so much.
Sorry for an overview, but I wanted you to see some richness and to see some of the areas that, from our experience, we touch, but that will point to some directions that are out there, I hope, because they come out of people doing work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Paul. And introduce now Skip Pizzi, who's Manager of Technical Policy for Microsoft's Entertainment and Devices Division. Skip.
Thanks, Peter, and happy to be here, sort of on short notice. For those of you who do know me, I wear a bunch of different hats in this world and was hoping to come to this as just a civilian, enjoying a couple of days of interesting discussion, but got pressed into service yesterday to fill in for Bill, who I was looking forward to seeing, too, from Yahoo. So here I am with the Microsoft hat on, representing the big corporate sort of internet portal operation and what they think or what they're doing in terms of a look at the world of public media in general. So you've seen some in Peter's overview. You've seen some more just now from my biblio. And so let's take a look at just a real quick overview, and then I have some sort of disconnected thoughts to kind of finish up with. Start with MSN, very typical website kind of. This is the video page from MSN, and it's real typical type of a website that you've probably all seen, and there are a few different ways you can select between different preferences amongst what's all on the video there. Most of this is real popular stuff, although in the music side, there's a bunch of stuff right now from the Jazz and Heritage Festival down in New Orleans, kind of redefining, stretching the definition of jazz here, but there's at least Terrence Blanchard there, so that's one real jazz performer. And the idea is very similar to what you would have on any other kind of a web page. A little more sort of video specific might be the way Yahoo's doing it, but again, you notice that all of these are selected, very intermediated kinds of sites. Much like a broadcaster, except there's no clock to fill a 24-hour schedule with. It's just what you want to put up there, what deals you have. And the only real sort of interactive public nature for any of these is in the idea of what is the most popular, what's been voted on by the user's selection, what's been played the most, and you have some channels and so forth that you can choose from, but basically there's no real public or user-generated content in here. Google takes a little step further, puts a number of things up there with these little thumbnails, and there's Stephen Colbert and the Bush impersonator from, and again, these are the what they feature, right? So they're selecting, still an intermediated type of site, and then a couple other channels, one sort of new school, one sort of old school in terms of branding. You have their version of what are the most popular, or you can go to the whole top 100 list of popular choices. So that's basically your only sort of user input to this. Their sort of random approach, too. So that's just three variations on a user interface of what is essentially the same thing, a media site. Now, the other side of this for the radio folks here is most of these sites have music, TV or video and movies, and there's nothing really there called audio. In other words, there's radio in some cases, and what it is radio stations, music stations typically, a music format of one form or another. So not really anything specifically there. Microsoft also has a place for its Media Center Edition home PC, which is a sort of this idea of a PC as a home entertainment sort of core. And on that, you can go to a site. It's also an intermediate site called their online sort of featured choices, online spotlight they call it. Now there, NPR is one of the choices. So you can go to the NPR site and listen to actual NPR news audio on the site. But otherwise, these are not really sort of channelized in any particular way. And I think that's the point here is that it's just another form of mediation. On the other hand, the other extreme would be the so-called open media network, which we've heard a little bit about. This is really a pretty different model. And when you download their player, it looks kind of like this. It's basically a peer-to-peer. It's using the same Contiki engine that the BBC model uses that Peter mentioned earlier. And this obviously looks really different. If you go to the full all selections here, you can sort it alphabetical or by review or however you want. I just have it sorted by date here. And let's start scrolling down here, and look what we find is that, I'm on page 18 of 600 screens here. So that's the other side of the coin. No intermediation. So now what do you do? Well, obviously their challenge is to how do you make this somewhat more usable. So you can sort all these different ways, and because this does have audio and video together, and it tells you the format and whether it's audio or not, and whether it's just audio or video. And so you can sort by the different sort of categories, or you can sort by this tagging idea here, which is actually pretty useful. I don't have it sorted at all. I'm just sort of taking the whole bundle here. And the reason, one of the reasons why there's so much stuff on there is just all you have to do is flip over to here and submit your stuff. Now, there is some, as you see the little policies here, there is some moderation to it. It's more of a, I guess it's called moderation rather than mediation, that's not too fine a point. But there's not really any sort of choices or deals being cut. There are just some pretty fairly routine kinds of criteria of choice. Nothing pornographic or obscene, those kinds of things. So, basically it's almost all takers get posted up there. And this one is a sort of a non-profit kind of a site specifically for public broadcasting. But that gets me kind of just to show you where we're at with this. I think obviously there's a balance that's required between the intermediation and disintermediated sites like this, because there is no time-based limits. There's basically no limits. It's essentially just how much storage do you want to put out there. So how much do you, where does that balance fall? And I think you're going to find that the differentiation between the sites is really going to be where they put themselves in that continuum of balance. And for a lot of brands, why not just go to the broadcaster's site themselves, like NPR.com and so forth, .org rather, and then you could find just their content there, or links to others and so forth. So there's a wide range range of possibilities here. And as David Leroy said earlier, we're in the very early instances of this. And if you look back in the history, broadcast radio and TV also took a long time to finally find their feet on a model that really worked. And I think we're way early on this. And as Professor Boyle said earlier, it's all about sort of it's kind of another version of that balance between open and closed, but in a sort of a different sort of model of choice. It's that sort of proxy by branding. In other words, people tune into NPR, let's say, or to a little broader extent, maybe watch PBS, a PBS station, to look at something that says, I don't care what I'm actually not seeking out a particular show. I just want to see what's on because I like their style. I like they're my proxy of choice for filtering the world or the world of today's news to my kind of taste. Or maybe you like Fox for different reasons, but I mean having them do the same sort of filter of your world for you, or vice versa. So there's a lot of different options there, but it's all about sort of making sense of this just, you know, huge amount of stuff that's getting bigger all the time. The one learning that I think we have from all this in the digital world is that to broadcasters, particularly, but essentially to any business, the digital world makes it easier for you to produce your content, but it makes it harder to acquire and retain a customer because of the very ease of production. It just dilutes the marketplace with more and more and more stuff. It can make you, if you're good at it, also be better, faster, cheaper at doing it, which helps. But it, again, so can everybody else that's got some skills and some resources. And as a result, then you need to be able to, as a broadcaster, work even harder to keep that audience, retain that audience and strengthen, continue to strengthen your brand. So it's a real challenge, a real two-edged sword. So let me throw out a couple other some points here in terms of what this means. I think that that dilution is actually a really good thing. It's hard to avoid being in Boston thinking sort of about the history and certainly American history. And one of the founding fathers I think is often unappreciated is John Locke. And his basic premise was that this marketplace of ideas should be completely open and unfettered, even to the unpopular extremes, to be let in there. Because if that happens, it prevents any one idea from being disproportionately powerful. And so that is certainly what we've got here in this sort of commonplace where you have so many ideas being able to be shared. So at a real high sort of philosophical level, that's a good thing. I think, though, that what broadcasters are doing is to pick up on the professor's model of the Tarzan economics that's kind of resonated through a number of presentations already. Broadcasters have, but people in traditional media, legacy media, whatever you want to call it, have the opportunity to not have to let go of the first vine before they grab or try a bunch of the other vines because they still have the legacy broadcast. It's a very different kind of medium. They have to learn how to swing a little on the new rope because it's pretty different. That's sort of, it's not so much one to many anymore, and it's a different economic model. But they don't have to, it's not a total replacement. They can keep, in fact, probably one of the big, most powerful synergies going in media today is this on-air and online combination, because they fit nicely. You can do things online that you can't do on air, time shifting, on demand, tell me more kind of content, for example. And there's things that you can't do online that you can do on the air, like hit everybody at once with a cheap portable receiver without having the number of people listening have any impact on your cost or on the system's workability. So those are two pretty different models that if you're a media producer, a content producer of any kind, can both work for you well, and you don't have to necessarily choose one or the other. The existing broadcasters, incumbent broadcasters, obviously have an advantage of being licensed to use the scarce spectrum that they do have to do their model. So broadcasters have it made because they can get into the other world. They can get into the online world, whereas pure online participants can't necessarily access the broadcast world. So you really, if you are coming from a broadcast facility, a licensed user of that spectrum, you've got really, it's your game to lose in terms of how you leverage that existing brand and service and add the new stuff to it in the online world. It's also becoming a multi-platform world. It's not just the internet sort of as a big cloud anymore. You have all these different kinds of platforms that access that big cloud, all the way down to these sort of handheld devices, which are obviously the big new wrinkle. And getting rich media into these things is now becoming an actual reality. In the next year or two, we'll see a lot of that happening and being heavily marketed. So expect to see that, but how you can maybe tailor and tune content. At the recent NAB show, that was one of the big technical themes, was one content to many different platforms. How do you do that and do it, you know, cost effectively and still be able to optimize for the different screen sizes, the different sort of user behaviors, short form versus long form, and so forth. So that, I think, is an important thing. And again, it also moves us beyond broadcast. The next-gen products that are coming out with this are really a 3G phone and a broadcast receiver, because the early users of video on cell phones realized, and the network operators certainly have realized, that it's not a very good system when you're clogging up that with all that bandwidth from trying to download or watch real-time video. So what they're doing is, with these new devices, there's a 3G phone in there to make the transaction, but you're actually getting the content delivered through a broadcast station. So you have systems like MediaFlow and another one called Modio, and there's one in the UK called Movio. They all sort of rhyme with radio, but they're very, you know, and they're all point-to-multipoint transmissions, but they're sending content to this device that is transparently two devices in one. It's another sort of convergence in your pocket, so to speak. It's got both a phone, two-way communication, point-to-point device, and a digital receiver that will allow all that broadband content, the high bitrate content, the video and audio, to be taken off of the 3G network, off of the expensive network, and put out in point-to-multipoint mode. So again, you see the two sort of forms coexisting for their mutual benefit. I think where we're going here is, again, we're obviously all here because we're thinking about beyond broadcast, but this conference isn't called replacing broadcast. It really is that we're talking about a superset of what broadcast does. So you have to kind of, it's easy for us to always think about, oh, this next thing is just going to totally eclipse the old thing. And that's not, I don't think, really the dynamic here. Where is public media in this space, finally? I think that's the sort of second but deeper, more important question amongst this convocation here. I think one of the things we're learning, which is odd, is that public media isn't necessarily non-commercial or certainly not necessarily non-profit anymore. Public media has become sort of a format name, a style of content, as much as it has defined the origin of the company or the sort of makeup of the content creators. Certainly it would be, I think, retain largely a non-profit origin, but look at XM Satellite Radio, for example. They have a channel. They're obviously a commercial organization. They have a public radio, XMPR, it's called, XM Public Radio Channel, with, turns out, a lot of ex-NPR folks over there that are doing programs for it. But the point is, it's a style of content. When you say public radio now, you define it's like saying classic rock. I mean, you just sort of know what they mean. It's not necessarily that it's non-commercial, or certainly not to the general listener, that it's coming from a 501c3 organization. But that if it's not, then it's not really the stuff they want to hear. So
can we, at that point, pass it over to the audience? That's a really great point to do that. We've got time for a few questions. Who would like to pose one?
Actually, why don't we start with the question tool? We haven't used that yet, so let's see.
Go ahead.
Skip, when will Microsoft implement user-generated metadata?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's
okay.
Right. Yeah.
Next one.
Microsoft can't generate user-generated metadata because
just a simple one, I guess. How do you curate this space?
Implement.
And then I'll go look for audience questions. Peter,
how do you curate this space? Paul, Skip, either.
Well, we do this badly. However, we're involved with a bunch of archivists right now to work on digital archives and repository projects right now. The way we do it now is the people own their own information. So the way we don't curate a space as a traditional as a librarian may, more like an archivist, we curate the largeness of the collection. So within a collection, we often don't throw anything out unless it's illegal or slanderous or in violation of something. So, or if the person decides to withdraw their collection, which, you know, happens in actual archives, but we don't feel too bad about that, you know, if they decide they'd like their stuff to turn into a business, which we don't support, they can make businesses off of what they do, as, say, McGuinn does, or somebody sells a byproduct. So, our extent of curation is to make sure that the materials are alive, that they're cataloged in some way so that they can be found, that they're indexed and can be searched, which can be done automatically. But the power of ownership, which is slightly different than a traditional archive, is in the hands of the owner. Now, if and when any of these people were to die, which has happened in one or two cases, we do keep the material alive.
I guess in a way that's what you might call negative curating. I mean, it's keeping a bit of order there, but the creative curating, which is what I guess radio and television producers have always done to shape the material in order to make it a great viewing or listening experience, that's the missing piece, I think, in many of these.
I'm thinking of curating as an archivist, not as a...
Yeah. Right.
And that would be the same if you were the BBC archives, frankly.
I just have a comment and a question. Lauren Glenn Davidian from CCTV, Center for Media and Democracy. Mm-hmm. It reminds me when a lot of people have said we're at the very beginning, the early nanoseconds, and it reminds me of the early period after Marconi invented the wireless, and it precipitated what was described as a wireless mania. And when you think about having this tool for the very first time, which, you know, it's hard for us to imagine the time before telephone or the time before television, but we really are in this period where it's going to be the time before this beyond broadcasting model, and we're inventing it. So I just was interested in the technology that you talked about, and I just wanted you to repeat those three. You talked about movie flow.
Media flow, it's media, and then FLO stands for forward link only, because that's kind of revolutionary for the telcos to think about something that's a one-way delivery system. It's obviously a broadcast model. they're using what was Channel 55 of UHF TV in most of the country where they can get, where there's not already a TV channel that hasn't, an analog TV channel that hasn't moved off of that yet. So in some markets they won't get in there till 2009. With that, but they do have licenses around the country to do that. And it's a company called Qualcomm, but it's probably going to be marketed through like a Verizon or one of those kind of network operators. The other one is called Modeo, M-O-D-E-O. So a company called Crown Castle doing that. And they're an operator of cell phone towers all over the country and in the world. In fact, they're UK-based. But it's Crown Castle US doing Modeo. Again, that won't be the marketing name. It'll be whoever they sign up as a network operator. And then the one in the UK that's already been up and running is from British Telecom called Movio. So the idea is that you really will be like, it's like watching TV, real-time TV, on your cell phone, your handheld device, as well as being able to download stuff that you can watch later, like when you're in a subway tunnel or something and you can't get the real-time connection. Battery life's an issue, obviously, and how big the screen is an issue, and some of these will work out. But that's an example of something that's obviously going to be a new platform coming in the next couple of years.
Okay, we have to wrap it up there. Thanks to the panel. Thanks to you all. Obviously... Obviously, the discussion goes on this afternoon. The issues remain on the table. And this balance between, on the one hand, it's just the beginning, but on the other hand, there's great things we can already start to do, seems to me a really exciting way forward. Thank you so much.